giant karmic explosion of his had somehow vacuumed all the karma right out of Griffin, like some killer black hole just hoovered him clean. Griffin didn't know. New Age philosophy wasn't his thing any more than Christianity or astrophysics was. All he knew was that his life started unraveling the moment Cameron Harris entered it, but that Cameron still seemed his best hope for stitching it back together. Cameron never responded to his letter, which was, Griffin supposed, a kind of response in itself. But while he was still holding out hope, he met Honeybun for drinks one evening over in Silver Lake. By this time, Honeybun had landed a job on, to Griffin's astonishment, another Lifetime reality show. This one called Little Women, L.A. About five women, little people, not midgets, came Bun's admonition, living life below the four-foot mark. But it was an assistant camera gig, journeyman work. Curiously, Little Women, L.A. would also suffer an on-camera bar brawl incident between cast members in January 2016, with Honeybun groaning from deja vu operating the camera. Honeybun did what he always did lately, extracted grumbles of praise from Griffin for his majestic and unerring gaydar, along with a formal admission of Griffin's error in having doubted him. Griffin submitted, having long since exhausted his excuses and by now embracing, relishing even, the concept of a gay Cameron Harris. Through the first round of drinks, they belly-ached about the torpid, glutted state of the reality show industry, Griffin likening it to end times of the traveling carnival era, before he started pitching his documentary idea. Honeybun sipped his drink through a straw and shrugged noncommittally as Griffin wound himself tighter and tighter into salesman mode. Honeybun sat listening to himself being inserted into the blueprint, Griffin charting the soulful new careers he was seeing for the two of them, a second vodka adding a rhapsodic note to Griffin's vision for the documentary. He talked as though he were reading from A.O. Scott's future New York Times review following the film's premiere at Sundance. Then Honeybun stopped him. "Whoa, go back to what you just said," Honeybun told him, "about the metaphor." "Yeah, yeah," Griffin said, baring his teeth in a grin. He threw back some of his drink and wiped his lips with a forearm. "That's how you can frame this, right? Cameron rising out of his wheelchair. That was like him coming out of the closet, stepping into his true identity, unlocking his real self. That was him rising into, like, the full flower of his humanity. You following me?"
No, Honeybun said flatly.
He'd worked on and off with Griffin for 10 years, and had come to love him like a brother. But like any brother, he sometimes longed to whack him with a bat. "You realize, right, that you're equating being gay with being paralyzed? That's just stupid and obnoxious."
"Not gay," Griffin said. He looked hurt. "Closeted."
"Dude." Honeybun shook his head. "You're just not getting it. Being paralyzed is being paralyzed. It's not a metaphor for anything. It's a neurological fucking condition." Griffin frowned and shrugged, wary of tainting a rare night out with Bun, but also too secure in his vision to engage the point any further. He started in on the potential for grant money, Honeybun stirring the dregs of his drink and looking away to scan the crowding rooftop bar and beyond it the sun setting over the Pacific, saying, "Uh-huh," saying, "Sure." Griffin, uncharacteristically oblivious to the fact that he was failing to close the sale. One more small thing, among so many larger others that year, that he'd find impossible to understand. The January 25th church bulletin at Our Lady Queen of Angels Catholic Church, which Cameron Harris, like most parishioners, skipped reading, included something odd. Inside a box claiming a sixth of a page in an urgent-looking, bolded, italicized 14-point font was a passage from St. Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians, one of the later books of the New Testament. "For as often as ye eat this bread and drink this cup, ye do show the Lord's death till he come. Therefore whosoever shall eat this bread and drink this cup of the Lord unworthily shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and then let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. For he that eateth and drinketh unworthily eateth and drinketh damnation to himself, not discerning the Lord's body.
A few parishioners, after reading this, found themselves glancing toward Cameron, who sat blankly in a pew, alone as always, in the same front-left area he commonly occupied, wearing the same basic uniform, khaki pants, white button-down shirt, in which his mother had always dressed him for Mass. They interpreted this, correctly, as a warning shot from Father Ace, a warning shot that Cameron, having folded the bulletin and tucked it behind one of the hymnal books, failed to see coming. All Cameron knew of Father Ace's thinking came from a call the priest made to him after someone had alerted him to the contents of Landry's lawsuit.
"People are talking about some very strange rumors, and I will ask you to be straight with me," the priest said,
the irony skating past Cameron until recounting the call later. Cameron paused for a swallow, then promised to oblige. Father Ace asked,
"Do you know what these rumors are?"
"I got some idea, yes, sir."
"And is there any truth to what they're saying about your inclinations?"
"My inclinations?" He released a bubble of anxiety as a grunt. "I ain't sure what that means, Father."
"That you suffer from an attraction to men?"
I ain't sure about the suffer part, but yeah.
Cameron fumbled a cigarette from his shirt pocket while holding the phone with his other hand.
"This kind of personal, and I ain't real comfortable talking about it, but yeah, that's like the way I'm wired."
The priest sighed.
"We are all wired, as you say, for weakness. But what God asks of us is not only to resist sin, but to renounce it."
"Renounce it,"
Cameron repeated into the phone.
"The Lord delivered unto you an astonishing gift, Cameron Harris."
Cameron lit his cigarette, squinting.
"He did, yes, sir."
"And what is that saying you have here? The horse that offers you a gift, you should never punch it in the mouth."
"It's something like that, yes, sir."
"This has not come up in your confessions?"
Father Ace said.
"Well, I ain't done anything to confess to you," said Cameron. "Not since, you know, everything happened."
A hopeful lilt entered the priest's voice. As if on top of one miracle, he was finding layered another one.
"You no longer suffer this attraction?"
Now it was Cameron's turn to sigh.
"Father, I don't know how to confess to being what I am. That's kind of like asking you to hit me with 10 Hail Marys for having blue eyes. It ain't like I ever got a choice in the matter."
"Someone told you that,"
Father Ace said,
"and that person is wrong."
"No one told me that, Father,"
he said, his mind reeling 9 years back, to when he opened himself to Jim Yarbrough, his mom's boyfriend, as if to fact-check his own statement. But no, what Jim told him was that a leopard had spots, and a leopard couldn't choose not to.
"I ain't talked to but like 5 people about this my whole life. Who you're attracted to, it ain't like choosing between Coke and Pepsi.
Cameron,
I don't know how I'm supposed to confess to just to being alive."
"You are alive,"
the priest came back, icily now,
"because God created you, and you are walking today because God granted you an astonishing second chance. A miracle, Cameron."
"Then, but it's God who made me this way, Father."
He was hating every second of this, feeling hurled backward in time to when he was 14 and briefly believed, like Father Ace did now, that a choice was his to make, that willpower alone could relocate the true north of his desires.
"Because I swear to you, I sure didn't."
"You're very important to me, Cameron,"
Father Ace said, his voice coolly tightening.
"Not just personally, though I care about you a great deal, but to our ministry in Christ. Do you understand that?"
"Yes, sir, Father, I do."
"You have been healed in one regard, but you must heal yourself further."
Cameron exhaled a long gray stream of smoke, shaking his head.
"I can't change what I am, Father."
"This," the priest said, sighing, "is what a paralyzed man says."
Near the end of the 11 a.m. Mass on February 1st, 1 week after the menacingly bolded passage from 1 Corinthians appeared in the church bulletin, Cameron stood up as usual and filed into line for communion. While the Catholic liturgy's most revered sacrament, the routine is simple. The priest holds the communion wafer aloft and declares, "The body of Christ." The communicant cups his hands and says, "Amen," to receive the wafer into his hands, or else opens his mouth to receive it upon his tongue. Only this time it didn't go that way. Cameron stepped forward with his hands cupped, as usual, but Father Ace shook his head twice before jerking it sideways to move Cameron along. Confused, Cameron said again, "Amen," this time as a question, but Father Ace stood motionless and waxy-eyed, refusing him the sacrament. Cameron dropped his head, his face flushing hot as he made his way back to the pew, feeling the eyes of the church tracking him like those upon a convict shuffling toward the gallows. He remained in the pew, his own gaze fixed upon his shoelaces as the church emptied. Alone, lit by the polychrome shafts of Sunday light slanting through the stained glass windows, he found himself staring at the mahogany crucifix behind the altar, with its sculpted Jesus nailed to the cross. Cameron's focus narrowed to the expression on Jesus' face, serene and assured and fulfilled, unlike that of any dead man Cameron had ever seen. That was the point, Cameron supposed, that Jesus transcended all sorrow and agony. But didn't it also deny, he found himself wondering, an equally essential point, that Jesus was one of us, extraordinarily but ordinarily human, built from flesh and bones and nerve fibers, to which he too had to answer, master but also servant to all the pain and privations of bodily existence. Who Cameron was, inside, had never been any secret to Jesus. Whether God had designed him that way, or whether, as Father Ace implied, Cameron had somehow, with no memory to affirm it, redesigned himself. And yet Jesus had hoisted him to his feet anyway, reconnected his nerves, awarded him back the disorienting mess of his former life. He peered raptly and steadily at Jesus' expression. It wasn't the face of a deal-maker, a man who'd trade mercy for acquiescence. It was the face, if he stared long and hard enough at it, of a man who might understand. Father Ace, when he returned to the sanctuary, wore a different expression, that of a man scalded by betrayal. And from a distant, empathetic angle, Cameron gathered why. For 6 months now, Father Ace had been extolling Cameron from the altar, pointing to him as a model of God's infinite power and love. He'd pushed his skeptical bishop into greenlighting the miracle investigation, and had devoted hours and days to Cameron's case, hours and days that he could have otherwise bestowed on his parishioners with their rehab stints and restraining orders and dying parents and spiritual skidding. He'd staked his entire ministry, in some sense, upon Cameron, who now sat blinking at him, dejected and confused. Father Ace had brought him back into the church, and now he was kicking him out.
"Do you wish to make a confession?" Father Ace asked,
less an invitation than a challenge. It struck Cameron as such a small question. With Jesus hanging from the cross behind and above the priest, his benevolent-looking presence looming large as the sky. Weakly, Cameron said, "For being me?" The priest shut his eyes and very slowly shook his head, as though counting something off.
"This cannot be the way," he finally said, "that you repay his incredible mercy."
"Father," Cameron pleaded, "I don't feel, not in here, like who I am is wrong."
"Until you renounce your sins and deliver your weakness unto the Lord," Father Ace said, backing away to punctuate this as his final statement, the folds of his cassock seething in retreat. "You cannot be said to be living in a state of grace, and therefore I cannot and will not grant you the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist."
He paused inside a ribbon of color-stained sunlight.
"With great tenderness in my heart, I leave this choice to you."
It wasn't until Cameron was outside, descending the steps of the church, that it struck him. He noticed his legs carrying him down the concrete stairs, as only he could notice them. Watched them flexing and tautening and flexing again beneath his khaki pants as they conveyed him to the base of the steps. He wheeled around and faced the open church door, the flooded veins of his neck surging.
"I'm not living in a state of grace,"
he said aloud, unconsciously shifting from foot to foot in a defiant shuffle step, every one of his lower body's nerves thrumming and twitching, his voice climbing from a choke to a shout.
I'm not.
The trucking magnate Norton Skaggs' response to Cameron's homosexuality, delicately disclosed to him from Rome by Dr. Antonio Luni, after Euclide Abash's report from Georgia, was all of two words. Who cares? This took Dr. Luni by surprise, partly because it echoed Euclide's nonplussed reaction. Dr. Luni had been ascribing the latter, however, to his investigator's youth and loose cosmopolitan leanings, as well as to his over-lawyerly way of interpreting the Gospels. Of the 2,026 words attributed to Jesus in the four Gospels, Euclide exasperated him by pointing out not a single one addresses homosexuality. But Skag? Dr. Luni had been girding himself for smoking brimstone to come spraying from his phone. Dr. Luni is of an older generation of Catholics, less apt to view church doctrine as something malleable and elastic, and his impression of Skag was of a man even farther to his right, a paleoconservative in matters theological. Skag was known in the United States to be a significant donor to socially conservative politicians, a cash machine for the nation's culture warriors, particularly generous to anti-abortion activists. On the phone with Dr. Luni, however, Skag wasn't interested in theology or politics or even morality. He was only interested in a miracle for the Reverend Fahey.
The recipient doesn't matter, Skag growled. You explained that to me yourself 20 years ago. Doesn't matter if he's a fairy. The miracle is what matters.
This was true, Dr. Luni was forced to agree, but only in a legalistic sense. After nearly half a century as a lawyer, Dr. Luni understood the wide gulf between the theory of the law, canon law especially, and its practice. Still, he did as his client demanded. He proceeded forward with the claim. He didn't have far to proceed. On March 16th, the head of the Biloxi Diocese, Bishop Xavier R. Coburn, retracted diocesan support for the miracle inquiry due to irredeemable inconsistencies in testimony, and disbanded the four-man board he'd appointed to oversee it, effectively blocking Fahey's route to sainthood as it wound through Cameron Harris. Skag was incensed. This time sparks did fly from Dr. Leone's phone, Skag breathing fire all the way from Detroit. It was a conference call, Euclide patched in from Washington.
What do these sons of bitches want down there?
He asked, suggesting Euclide tender some kind of offer.
A new church? Fine. A rec center? A seminary? My checkbook's right in front of me. They can have all the zeros they want on it. I mean, for God's sake, all we're asking them for is a stamp so the case can move on up to the consulta.
Cautiously, Dr. Luni said, It's not exactly how these things are done.
But it's ridiculous, Skag fumed. This is a slam-dunk case. Archbishop Fahey healed this boy clear as day, and they're brushing it aside. Why? I'd like one of these sons of bitches to tell me why.
Euclide cleared his throat. Because they're scared, he said.
Scared of what?
The resonance, Euclide said.
I don't even know what that means, Skag grumbled. All I know is that mercy's not to be feared. Mercy's to be celebrated.
This happened to align with Euclide's view, but he took it one step further than Skag might have. Love, in whatever form it took, wasn't to be feared either. And this was why in early April, while Euclide was in Tallahassee, Florida, looking into a cancer remission case that had barely a tenth of the miracle potential of Cameron's case, he found himself using a free day to drive 4 hours to Biloxi. When no one answered the door at the house on Reckonford Avenue, Euclide called Janice, by now aware that Father Ace had washed his hands of Cameron. Janice seemed weirdly protective of Cameron, though she and Euclide had spoken on the phone since their interview to jointly clear the suspicions about him. This still felt like a shift. After Euclide explained his purpose, though, she texted him Cameron's number with a message saying he was full of surprises. Cameron, more so than Janice, also sounded wary on the phone. Euclide promised him he was paying an unofficial call, unrelated to church business, but said he was working a slip shift at work and would be headed home shortly for a couple hours. He'd meet him there. With time to kill, Euclide wandered down to the Busy Bee, exchanging pleasantries along the way with an old woman on her porch, who, noting his accent, hollered out,
"Where you from, child?"
The miraculous discount sign was still hanging across the front of the store, and inside were printouts of the news coverage taped haphazardly to the walls, but there was little otherwise to denote what had happened there, a far cry from Euclides' last visit. From the man behind the counter, whom he took to be Quinn, Lady Hat's husband, Euclides purchased the single worst cup of coffee he'd ever tasted and carried it outside. He stood near the door for a while, watching a man sweep the parking lot, the man uttering strange bleeding sounds with every third push of his broom. The man paid extra attention, Euclides noticed, to the section of the asphalt where Cameron had risen, still faintly marked. When he was done sweeping, the man rested a while in that very spot, leaning on his broom, slightly swaying, his eyelids fluttering and his lips softly trembling. Euclides observing him over the rim of his paper coffee cup. Yes, Euclides thought, his lips bending into a slow smile. God is there, friend. Don't let anyone tell you he's not. He arrived back at the house just as Cameron was pulling into the driveway. Cameron climbed out of the car in a uniform. Shiny black pants and a bright blue shirt onto which a gold badge was pinned. Shaking hands and leading Euclides inside, Cameron told him that he was a month into his new job at the airport, working for the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, or as Cameron wryly put it, America's varsity squad. Polyester uniform aside, Euclides was struck, after all this time spent circling him, by how unremarkable Cameron seemed. By the folksy Huckleberry Finnness of him, the accommodating grin, the gleaming blue boyishness in his eyes, his must-sticky-looking hair, the clumsy cowboy drawl, the unkempt way he chugged half a quart of Gatorade standing in front of the open refrigerator. He seemed both familiar and exotic to Euclides, irregularly regular, and every man who from various angles resembled and evoked no one else. Euclides didn't stay long. His mission was a narrow and very precise one. And on one basic level, unlike most of his others, he was there not to receive information, but to dispense it. But he began with a question anyway. "Have you spoken with Sergeant Lockwood since your recovery?" Cameron's face paled, a range of expressions swirling across it. He reached for a cigarette, Euclides saw, in much the same way Dr. Leone reached for an aspirin when his chest began stinging. "The?" Cameron said. "No, sir, I ain't." "I have," Euclides announced. Cameron nodded, Euclides inventorying what he saw flickering through Cameron's eyes. Resurrected pain, maybe. Guilt. An old and persistent confusion. And something brighter, too. The thing Euclides hoped to see. "I am very certain he would welcome hearing from you," Euclides told him, from his vest pocket fishing a folded piece of paper with Demarcus's cell phone number on it, and passing it to Cameron. Cameron unfolded the paper and stared at it, as though reading a long and emphatic letter. "That's really all I came this long way to say," Euclides said, adding, "I thought I should do it in person." Cameron's mouth opened to speak, but nothing but air came out.
"You and he, it seems clear," Euclides said, "have some unfinished business," tapping his chest.
Cameron sat motionless for a while, not even blinking. Euclides continuing to tap at his chest until he was certain Cameron was registering his meaning, until Cameron's eyes were blooming as wide as they could bloom, his unlit cigarette poised motionless between his fingers. Before leaving Biloxi, Euclides stopped at Mary Mahoney's old French house, idly recalling the young waitress, lovely in his memory, who'd flirted him that second Negroni several months before. But she was off that day, the bartender told Euclides. He sighed and sipped his drink, watching the bartender wiping glassware in the window light, thinking maybe it was just as well. He'd had enough romance for one day. By dint of coincidence, or maybe owing to the crisscrossing spokes of small-town life, Knapp Cuevas was the first lawyer Tommy Landry contacted seeking representation a few days after the fight. Knapp having represented Landry's uncle 3 years before in one of the myriad cases arising from the BP oil spill. Knapp let Landry talk for about 10 minutes until his response felt fully formulated. Then he stopped him. "Mr. Landry, I've never said this to a prospective client before, and it's hard for me to imagine I'm ever going to say it to another one," he said. "But based upon some knowledge of this case that I happen to have, and on what you've told me so far, I'd like to invite you to go fuck yourself." And that, minus a few more turns of the screw, was how Knapp Cuevas became Cameron Harris's attorney. This story, exaggerated hardly at all, was soon being told and retold at dinner parties and in beachfront bars, with proud, whiskied zest, by an unexpected and unannounced visitor to the Mississippi coast. Janice's father, Winston Lorimer. He arrived at his daughter's house one night in early March, trailing a pair of disturbingly large suitcases along with Zeno, his fragrant plot hound, for what he described, blithely and benevolently, as an open-ended stay. He admitted he was rather early to greet the birth of his first grandchild, 6 months or so, but said the thought of Janny's belly blossoming so distant and unseen had been ripping him into confetti. Plus, he announced he wanted to deliver Janice her old crib from the attic. It wasn't actually Janice's old crib, rather her little brother Johnny's, because her old crib had been put to use as a brooder for ducklings. But it was a sweet gesture anyway, and Janice decided that, with a coat of paint, the crib could be adorable. And a tactile link as well to her mother, who was supposed to be here for this. Knapp, to Janice's surprise, seemed entirely, even irritatingly, unruffled by her father's invasion. His presence gave Knapp an excuse to mix his Sazeracs and provided him a partner for watching basketball, which Lorimer didn't particularly enjoy but found pleasant enough to stare at, so long as the volume stayed low. "Just can't take all them shoes squeaking." Janice, in contrast, found herself recurrently galled, though after a while more by the dog, who climbed daily onto the sun-drenched kitchen table to doze, than by her father, who seemed uncharacteristically inclined to help out around the house. He took over mowing the lawn, for instance, which was obliging of him, though she wished he wouldn't pilot the riding mower shirtless, wearing a scarf and goggles like Snoopy atop his Sopwith camel, to the neighborhood's gawky delight. From embarrassment, Janice sometimes found her hands covering her face, as they had so regularly done during her teens, but she also began noticing a curious shift in her view of her father. A softer, more forgiving focus, which she was crediting to being pregnant. She realized, as a mother-to-be, that she was locked into her lineage. She was an individual, of course, but also a kind of middleman, passing something more than mitochondrial DNA down the line, something deeper and less obvious than eye color and height and susceptibility to cancer. The differences, for the first time, felt less important than the similarities. Her father was crazy, yes, a yowling 67-year-old dervish, and his response to life had always been to flail at its mysteries and discordances with fabulous stories. But then she, too, as evidenced by the last few months, wasn't immune to that. Winston liked hearing about Cameron. He liked bringing the case up in bars in the late afternoons, squinting at locals claiming to have known it was a hoax all along. He liked visiting the Busy Bee and standing in that faded rectangle, chewing gum with his hands in his pockets. He liked ogling people in the Biloxi casinos, and whether they were impaired in any visible way or not, trying to determine why God might have opted to pass them over for a miracle. As a fiction writer, he sometimes invented backstories for them when the reason, someone snapping at a cocktail waitress, cussing a slot machine, general inertness, wasn't obvious to him. The reasoning he devised for Cameron's selection, on that note, went like this. "One by one, God took away the boy's daddy, his dog, his mama, his first true love, then his legs. After a while, God felt bad about all that, so he gave back the legs." His daughter didn't mind this interest. In fact, she rather enjoyed it, as her father had never before paid much attention to her work. But she did find herself trying to steer him away from the metaphysical toward the physical, from the invisible to the visible. Winston Lorimer isn't religious, but he is fond, in his words, of
the hoodoo in life.
The cracks in our knowledge and perceptions, the existential equivalent of the unplayable tones lurking between the black and white keys of a piano. Janice did have to concede to him that what was visible about Cameron's case was limited and ambiguous, that the only conclusion the data and imaging could muster was a shrug. She was still doing what she could to investigate the case, feeling obligated to redouble her efforts after having steered herself into a ditch with her hoax theory. She'd experienced no eureka moments, not yet, and her progress felt measured in inches, but she had, nevertheless, arrived at a few conclusions. One was that whatever neuroregenerative process occurred had happened slowly, not instantly, so that Cameron's rise from his wheelchair marked not the moment of his recovery, but rather his realization of it. His lack of sensory response until then was likely psychological, a kind of reverse placebo effect, Cameron failing to notice the changes because his mind kept invalidating them. Her second conclusion was that his ability to stand and hobble a few steps despite his atrophied leg muscles was more than likely an adrenaline response. Cameron's combat history, which she heard about from Euclide and verified with Cameron, suggested a man unusually reactive to the effects of adrenaline, able to channel those effects into very specific physical actions. And the third was that some anomaly in the glial scar environment, and that was as precise as she could get, some anomaly, had allowed neuroregeneration to transpire where medical science says it can't, akin to a flower blooming in the absence of light.
"So that's the story you're telling?" her father said one night, after she'd laid it all out for him.
They were sitting on the screened-in patio, Janice chiding her father for smoking, and her father pretending not to hear. He had a tall glass of bourbon in front of him, her a steaming cup of healthy mama herbal tea. Zeno was snoring by his feet, having exhausted himself chasing moths, and the backyard was clamorous with cicadas, 1,000 miniature tambourines being shaken in the dark.
"It's not a story, Daddy," she said. "Come on, it's a hypothesis. It's as empirical as I can get right now."
"Nah,"
he said, pursing his lips and shaking his head a shade too smugly for Janice, like someone holding the answer to a guessing game.
"A hypothesis, that's just a story told a different way. It's a summary of observations, right? This led to that. When this happens, this other thing here does."
"That," she said, shooing smoke away, "is a seriously simple way of looking at it."
"Simple? Here's simple."
He stubbed out his cigarette and took a bracing sip and a half of bourbon, grimacing happily. Winston Lorimar no longer resembles David Levine's illustration of him in the New York Review of Books circa 1979, when Lieutenant Lucius and the Tri-State Crematory Band was the passing rage. His face has widened and gone pouchy, and the wild man shock of hair that Levine accentuated went swirling down the bathtub drain decades ago. But the jungly eyebrows and over-plump lips that dominated Levine's rendering still dominate Winston Lorimar's face, imbuing his expressions with something of an epic quality. When he draws a cigarette to his lips, it might as well be a roasted turkey leg. When he laughs, it feels on behalf of an entire realm, or at least a pub. He exudes a largeness of spirit, something overcrowded within.
"Tolstoy said there's only two stories in all of literature," he began. "Fella goes on a journey, that's one. Stranger comes to town, that's the other. Or in this case here, I reckon we'd say anomaly comes to town."
His face glowed puckishly.
"Sounds a little Greek, doesn't it? Hail ye anomaly, scion of Medicina."
"Science isn't stories, Daddy,"
Janice said flatly, reminded anew why she'd relished living in Pittsburgh during med school. No one ever seemed to sit on porches making up stories.
"Oh, of course it's just stories," he said. "Fella goes on a journey. That's Darwin's plot. That's evolution. This fish, see? He's bored. Wants to check out what's beyond the water. So he jumps out onto the land, gives it a quick look, see? Says I'm gonna need me some lungs and some feet. But he don't got them. So he tells his fish kids, and they tell their fish kids, until one of them grows some lungs and some feet, and next thing you know, they're living in trees gnawing bananas, until one of them says, 'Y'all watch this. I'm fixing to blow some minds by walking on 2 feet.'
and so on and so forth. Different fellas, but they're on the same journey.
Janice sipped her tea, hearing the cicada music recede and then crest behind her father's voice, finding herself both irritated and enchanted to feel 7 years old again.
"A Stranger Comes to Town, Tolstoy's other one," her father went on,
darkness creasing his face as some of the playfulness ebbed from his tone.
"Well, that's the earth itself coming into existence, isn't it? That whole ball of wax. Or pan out wider, and it's the origins of matter, of the universe. The story of a fella named Something, arriving at a place called Nothing."
Janice laughed. "All you're demonstrating," she said, adding some girlish velvet to her tone in order to blunt any sting, "is that if you make the box big enough, you can fit anything inside it."
He grunted softly, more stimulated than stung.
"But you're also missing a crucial difference," she continued. "Science doesn't tell. It asks."
He shrugged. "Same way stories do."
"That's so," she said, the arch of her eyebrow signaling more amusement than she was actually feeling.
"Oh, indeed. Indeed."
His big lips glistened from a fresh sip of bourbon.
"Stories, made-up ones anyway, they always begin with a tacit question. What if?"
"What if?" Janice echoed.
"That's right. What if," he said. "What if a woman named Anna married a mouse named Karenin, who fell dumbly in love with a louse named Vronsky? What if a little bitty redneck boy named Thomas Sutpen never got over a slave making him use the back door of a plantation house? What if biting a single cookie could crack open the essence of time itself, every one of the little bitty crumbs like atoms bursting with experience?" "Stories, see? They ask what if, the same way experiments do. They both start from the same place."
"And where's that?" He mulled this for a while, stretching his neck and surveying the backyard before announcing,
"LaFleur County, Mississippi."
"Oh, Daddy."
"Now hear me out, Jenny. Follow this old white rabbit for just a minute."
Janice waited while he dropped his gaze and cocked his head, as though struggling to hear something. He rubbed a fingertip against his glass.
"I could tell you two stories right now. One involves old Snuffy Covington, who was before your time. He was the county agent back in the 50s, real peculiar fellow, and he figured out how to control the bull weevil one night after listening to the Rocky Marciano Jersey Joe Walcott fight on the radio."
He paused to regard Janice's blank expression, then said,
"The other one's about your mama dying."
She nodded her selection at him, steeling herself, and he began with a question.
"You ever hear about the Hyder-Simmel experiment?"
Janice frowned at this starting-line digression, tightening her jaw and shaking her head no.
"A famous psychological study from back in the 40s, he explained. "Hyder and Simmel. They showed people a short film with nothing but a few geometric shapes moving along the screen, then asked those people what all they'd seen. Just like that, what'd you see? And all but one of them people come back with a story. The big triangle is trying to help the circle, they said. The little triangle was trying to get the circle away from the big one. The rectangle that didn't move was apathetic to the drama. That sort of thing. Only one of them, out of dozens, said he'd just seen some moving shapes. Just one of them."
Janice vented an impatient sigh.
"I thought this was about Mom. Those shapes," he shot back, "were your mama's cancer."
He studied the table for a while, his daughter studying him, the cicadas hushing themselves as though respecting the moment.
"Those shapes came to take her away, and every night the universe asked me what I was seeing," he went on. "And every night I tried telling myself and her and y'all a new story that wasn't just these meaningless shapes of cancer erasing her from our lives. Every night I wrote and revised those stories in my head because I refused, and to this goddamn day I still refuse, to accept her cancer as some movement of random shapes, as a purely biological concern. Because to accept that, I'd have to accept her as a random shape, too. As one more meaningless fragment in a meaningless mosaic. And she wasn't."
"No," Janice heard herself whisper.
No, she wasn't.
His hand gripped his glass, as though to lift it for a sip, but all he did was squeeze it.
She was extraordinary in every sense, but also in the sense that we're all extraordinary, that human life is extraordinary, that we're all somehow endowed with a consciousness allowing us to see with our eyes closed, to conjure what's not there, and sometimes what never could be there, and with lips and hands, too, that allow us to convey that vision to the consciousness of others, to transmit not only information, but meaning as well. Meaning and joy and heartbreak, and whatever the invisible molecules are that constitute love.
The cicadas crested again, and for a few speechless moments it appeared that father and daughter were doing nothing more than listening to them.
So I told stories, he said. Some of them were sad, and some funny, and some were ridiculous, and some were just me spinning whatever I had to keep spinning to keep from crying. Maybe they weren't the best stories, and if I could do it all over again, I might have kept back a few of them from you and your brothers, because the trust of a child is infinite, but so easily breakable, too. But I couldn't be like that single cold bastard from Hyder and Simmel's experiment. I couldn't accept her dying as just her dying. If there were laws to the universe, then those laws had to be just ones, and I felt it was mine to prove that somehow. To myself, if no one else. Otherwise, what cause did I have to put you and the boys on the school bus every morning? Make y'all finish your greens every supper? What was to stop me?
He said, lifting his glass and shaking the ice as though brandishing a pistol.
From doing anything but this all day.
Janice hadn't registered much after his reference to the cold bastard, which she'd felt to be a drive-by slight aimed at, or at least near her, a half-concealed critique of her own clinical dispassion, her capacity for describing without ascribing, despite knowing that her hoax theory had shown these qualities to be more aspirational than inherent. Her mind swirled. The way her father had reckoned with her mother's illness and death had been an open wound for 23 years. But this fresh sting, a pinprick in comparison, was now eclipsing it. Did the deficit of imagination her father seemed to see in her bespeak a corresponding deficit of love?
But there's a true story, Daddy, she protested. And what's true doesn't need to be imagined. You can see it right in front of you. It wasn't shapes that took her. It was brainstem glioma. And that doesn't mean Mama died without meaning.
The way he smiled at her, like his heart was bunched in his throat, felt like a correction. It told her she'd misunderstood him, had substituted herself for her father's straw man, had imagined the slight. She'd always been too sensitive to his disapproval, she knew, even back when it had conversely validated her. She softened, watching her father's face twitch with thought or emotion. It was never clear with him where one stopped and the other started.
Imagination, he said to her, isn't just seeing what's not there.
His voice was gentle, a barrel-aged murmur.
Imagination is also what we use to figure out why what's there is the way it is.
She said nothing as he lit another cigarette, so forcefully shaking the match as to also shake off the old grief he'd summoned.
Let's throw William Blake's notion onto the table, he said, as Janice waved smoke from the actual table. That between what's known in the universe and what's unknown, there are doors. Imagination is the only thing that opens those doors.
Janice sighed. Imagination is also the quickest path down rabbit holes, she said, thinking of her own.
That's surely true.
Her father let out a smoky grunt.
I reckon history would show rabbit holes outnumbering Blake's doors by about 100,000 to 1.
But the questions I'm asking about what happened to Cameron, she said, circling the conversation back to where it had begun. They're questions, Daddy. They're not parts of any story, and they're not imagined. I feel like you're lumping me in with all the miracle thumpers. I don't have something to prove.
Of course you do, he said. What you aim to prove is that the body, like the universe, works according to static laws. That what applies to one set of nerves applies to all sets of nerves. That the story, once identified, resolves the same way every time. The miracle thumpers, I like that phrase, they're desirous for the opposite. Isn't that right? that those laws can be suspended by higher power, that your biological fate is not necessarily mine. But it's too easy now to overstate these as competing aims. It's a common and rather toxic form of glibness, because what they are, see, they're just parallel routes to the same place.
And that's what?
Consolation,
he said. Not understanding?
Understanding's just a form of consolation. Understanding something means trusting that it's true. Doesn't mean it is true. Just that you believe it is.
Janice smiled, wagging her head and emitting a low, exasperated moan. If we were on the phone, she said, a dimple dotting her cheek, I'd be saying, sorry, Daddy, you're breaking up on me.
Well, that's why this here's better, he said, mashing her dimple for dimple as he ashed his cigarette.
He leaned forward.
All I'm saying to you is that what happened with this boy was more than mechanical. I don't mean the actual mechanism, the anomaly. Thing is, you imagined him staying in that chair, and he somehow imagined himself out of it. You wrote one story, and by you I mean everyone relying upon our agreed-upon ideas of the known world, and his body wrote another. And all these people heard that story of his, and every one of them tried and failed to understand it, so they rewrote it in whatever way made sense to them, whatever way consoled them, until it didn't make sense to them anymore, so they had to write it another way. And maybe one of those stories was true, and maybe none of them were. Maybe the true story is the one you'll tell when you figure out the anomaly. But it won't really matter. Not in what we call the grand scheme.
And why is that? She said, feeling a faint twinge in her middle. The regular smoosh of digestion, probably, but possibly the baby's first tentative exploratory kick, another set of legs sparking with life deep inside her.
Because it's like what Muriel Rukeyser wrote,
her father was saying, dreamily now,
and peering out into the yard as if reciting lines printed upon the night sky. The universe is made of stories, not of atoms.
He turned to her with a grin, lush crinkles framing his eyes, and reaching not for his glass, but for his daughter's hand, he asked,
And isn't that, Doctor? Why, isn't that just about as beautiful as it gets?
Epilogue. The playlist for the trip was Cameron's. Patsy and Willie and Dolly and Tammy, all the old warbly-voiced, pedal-steel-smeared standbys, one twangy heartache after another. The route plugged into the GPS was likewise of Cameron's design. East to Mobile, up through the piney woods to Montgomery, then over to Macon for a wide northbound swoop around Atlanta toward the mountains and into White County, Georgia. The blue car, too, belonged to Cameron, though not in any technical sense. 3 months after the still-birthed cancellation of Miracle Man, no one from the production company or the network or from Ford had come to reclaim the twin sedans granted to its stars. Yet the driver, as always, was Tanya, a bonus-value light smoldering idly between her fingers on the steering wheel, like a stick of incense, her other hand pressing her phone to her ear.
"Ah, girl, you know," she was saying to a friend, "regular old Saturday, just driving to Georgia to meet my brother's gay black lover."
She flashed a wide and wicked grin her brother's way, silently cackling at her own teasing, and Cameron responded with a tolerant roll of his eyes before returning his attention to the landscape clicking past. Billboards for lawyers and preachers, tattered roadside memorial wreaths, homemade signs for deer processing with arrows pointing every direction, the earth painted a single mutt color of green and beige, save for the early pastel wildflowers bending in the spring breeze. Feeling his stomach nodding again, Cameron cracked the window and lit a cigarette, listening to Tanya going on about her new job at their mama's old hospital and the night classes she was taking to become a nurse. The job had her working with the elderly.
"I'm getting so damn good at wiping butts," she was saying,
but she was gunning for a slot in the pediatric ward. What she wanted was to work with kids. She was good at that, she thought. Her brother might be proof. Finishing the call, she announced,
"Cheryl says hey."
"Hey," he said back to the window.
"Says she still thinks she can turn you."
"Reckon I've been turned enough," he said.
Tanya dunked her cigarette into a coffee cup in the console, and then took in the passing scenery, humming vacantly along with a pedal steel solo. She blinked at the windshield, her eyes narrowing.
Do you remember riding up this way to see Aunt Belinda and them?
As Cameron shook his head no, she said,
Yeah, might be you were too little to remember.
He shrugged. Must have been.
Yeah, you were back in your car seat singing Barney songs, Mama singing along. Y'all about killed me with that. Guess you don't remember the bull, neither.
He swung his head. What bull?
Uncle Bill's. Thing was huge, with these big old horns, like those Texas cattle or something. You and me rode out with Uncle Bill to feed the hogs one night. You was in the bed of his truck when that bull come up and sticks his head right in there, snorting at you like this.
She flared her nostrils and grunted.
Then you got to screaming and kind of curled yourself into a ball, which just gets the bull more curious or something, so he's rocking the whole truck, sticking his head in there and snorting. You about peed your pants.
Cameron couldn't tell whether Tanya meant this as a funny story or not. It didn't sound funny to him. What did Uncle Bill do?
Oh, you know him. He was off feeding the pigs and shouting at you not to worry, saying the bull was friendly. You wasn't buying it.
After a few beats of silence, Cameron stared at her and asked, What were you doing?
Me?
Tanya frowned, as if her own role in the incident hadn't occurred to her.
I was back there with you, trying to keep that bull off you. I started shoving his head away and shit, pushing on its nose.
Telling me it was all okay, Cameron said. She brightened.
You remember now?
No. His voice was quiet, pensive, but assured. I just figured. He took a drag from his cigarette, exhaling the smoke sideways out the cracked window. You always been protecting me, ain't you? He said. Tanya swallowed, eyes fixed upon the highway.
Not always, she said.
It sure felt like always to me.
What to say to this, Tanya didn't know.
A Freight Connects tractor trailer hurtled past in the left lane, Reverend Fahey's quotation on its backside passing unnoticed. Kitty Wells was singing a duet with Red Foley, sounding to Tanya like some archaeological recording engineered with tin cans and fence wire. Cracker Barrel, 2 miles ahead. A boarded-up church off the frontage road, its sign reading, The Bible Prevents Truth Decay. Finally, she said,
That wasn't me back at the Busy Bee.
Wasn't me neither, said Cameron. For a long while thereafter, they rode through Alabama in silence, the mystery riding with them as it probably always will, its presence disturbing and comforting and shifting but ultimately equal measures, undeniable yet unfathomable, a ghost of wonder that may never cease to haunt them and those close to them, untethering them from the world's known limits. Perhaps this will always be their routine, a reminder, a thick and ponderous silence, and then an unsettling sense of strange liberty and stranger privilege. Tanya lit another cigarette, as Cameron was absently doodling the window with a fingertip, as though tracing the contours of the highway side.
You nervous?
She said. Little bit, he admitted.
I mean shit, she said,
squinting less from the sun than from the thoughts in her head.
All these years gone by, and y'all ain't been nowhere together except Afghanistan.
She paused, wagging her head as she absorbed her own words, ingesting the dilemmas of her brother's nearing future.
What the hell do you even do?
I don't know, said Cameron, still tracing something onto the window, the glass cold against his wandering fingertip. Yet his voice, moving 70 miles an hour in the open right lane, was without shakes and quivers, that vein in his neck pulsing gently and unseen. I guess it's like everything else. You just hope it was real. Afterward. In November 2015, as part of a research initiative orchestrated by Janice Lorimar Cuevas, M.D., Cameron Harris flew to New Haven, Connecticut, to undergo a 5-day battery of tests, including a spinal tap for evaluation of his cerebrospinal fluid, at the Yale School of Medicine's Center for Neuroscience and Regeneration Research. His case is also under investigation by Stephen Levitin, Ph.D., professor in the departments of neurology and neurobiology at the University of California, Berkeley, a senior Veterans Administration medical research scientist, and one of the nation's foremost authorities in the field of axonal regeneration and remyelination. At the time of this book's publication, however, the research has yet to yield any conclusive determinations about Cameron's recovery, except, per Dr. Levitin's terse formulation, that somehow it happened.
This is Eduardo Ballerini. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Anatomy of a Miracle by Jonathan Miles. This program was directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Nick Martorelli. Text copyright 2017 by Jonathan Miles. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.